Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, before we get the show started, I wanted to let you know we are giving away a bunch of brand new Black Magic gear.
Yeah, cameras, switchers, DaVinci Resolve licenses, a bunch of awesome stuff. So stay tuned to learn how you can enter to win free gear from Black Magic, and we're going to tell you all about it later on in this episode. Now cue the music. Hey, what's up, guys? Welcome to the 91st episode of Just Shoot It, a podcast about filmmaking, storytelling, and directing. I'm Oren Kaplan.
And I'm Matt Emma. Today we've got Brad Peyton on. He's directed a ton of Hollywood movies that you've heard of before.
So he directed Cats and Dogs 2, Journey to San Andreas. He has a Netflix show called Frontier. He has San Andreas 2 coming out in a while. It's announced, at least. And then, he just finished directing Rampage, based on the video game. He's also doing Journey 3. I mean, the guy's doing every giant movie. His first movie was an $80 million film.
Yeah. Learn what it takes to direct like highly CG-heavy filmmaking. We really dig in deep on how he approaches pre-visualization, CGI, and working with actors. It's a great conversation. We actually broke it up into two parts, so stay tuned for the finale of it. We'll dig in and talk to Brad Peyton in just a minute. But before we do that, Oren, I'm really, really dying to know. What have you been working on lately?
Well, believe it or not, our regular viewers know that I've been pitching this show, Warigami, for months and months and months and traveled around. And anyway, we finally freaking started the writer's room this week.
Hey, congrats, man.
Thanks. So it's been really fun. Today's only day two, but there's like basically the three of us, the creators and another writer and a writer's assistant. We're starting a little small for the first week just to kind of break out. We have three assignments: the themes, the character arcs, and the world. And it's stuff that we all kind of know, but now we actually have to be definitive about. You know, we've always had these ideas like, oh yeah, and then these two characters meet, and then this thing happens, but their parents died or whatever. But now we have to figure out how their parents died, and why, and when, and how do they meet, and all that stuff. And so we've been getting homework every night. So the very first night's homework was to bring in a cool action scene that you really like and to explain why you like it. Like, we'd play it in front of the room and we talk about what we like about it. So I brought in two scenes. I brought the record throwing scene from Shaun of the Dead, just because it's such like a fun improvisational scene. It's where the characters in Shaun of the Dead learn how to fight zombies, and they are throwing records at them, but they're like looking through their record collection to make sure they're only like throwing the shitty records at them. And then I had a scene from Mad Max where Max fights Furiosa and he's chained up to a passed out guy, the other character that he's with. And just the choreography of that scene and who's on top, it's like so dynamic and so interesting. And it's just a great fight scene. So I brought those two scenes in. We talked about them. The other people brought in scenes, and it was really fun. And then our next assignment was to just kind of pitch our own version of the backstory for all the characters. So that's what we did last night. And tonight's assignment, which I'll have to write after we finish recording, is we each got assigned a character to write like a journal entry for. Mm-hmm. Just something when I was at Disney, we would like, I mean, this will show you how long ago this was, but we would make like MySpace profiles for each character.
that's real cute.
You know, what music they like, what their favorite movies are, those things.
I can't wait to learn who your character's top eight friends are, though.
Yeah, well, Tom is number one. Tom from MySpace. That might mean something to someone listening to this. But anyway,
shout out to Tom.
It's been fun. You know, we haven't really cracked the story, and we will. What I like about our room specifically is like people will adamantly pitch ideas, and then someone else will be like, oh, but what if it was this totally different thing instead? I feel like we're really open to like saying like, oh yeah, that is better. It's been good so far. we're moving really slowly, so I hope we have stuff done.
How much longer are you guys in the room for?
So we have 3 weeks to get our first season outline done.
Okay.
And so the first week we're working on theme, world, and arcs.
Yeah, and then you start breaking next week?
Yeah, next week we'll do the first half of the season, and then the following week the second half, which obviously it's not quite that organized, but that's what we're responsible to show Newform, the production company, at the end of each week. So it's cool. What about you? What have you been sleeping on lately?
Oh boy. So, nice segue there, Oren. I did a real weird one. This last week I did, basically I did a branded spot for, a sleep machine. As part of the deliverables, sometimes companies will have like these real out of the box, crazy ideas. And, you know, typically you hear like, oh, sure. We really want to do something crazy and weird and all this stuff. And by the time it gets to me, it's a 30-second spot where people say the name of the brand over and over again, and maybe I get a joke or two in. So finally, actually, this is one of those crazy cases where the crazy out of the box idea we ended up actually doing. So we did a 4-hour long
live to tape
thing that I probably shouldn't explain too much further, but we'll talk about later once it's released, probably early next year. But a long kind of endurance test, basically, of 4 hours live to tape. So like a sporting event, basically. And it was super fun, super weird, crazy, improv heavy. But so it was really fun, and kind of everything worked. It took a crazy long time to get things set up and get things right. But once we were shooting, we were in it, and, you know, we got it there. It was wild.
Cool, man. Yeah, I saw some of the footage because Sawhorse was the production company, and I was there the other day noodling around. That's, yeah, it looks really great. It looks like a sporting event, except it's a... Can we say that?
Well, that's the thing I was not saying.
Why? That's the whole hook.
Yeah, I know, but it hasn't been announced yet.
Oh. Well, that's awesome. Yeah, I can't wait to see how people react to it.
Yeah, it'll be super exciting.
Cool. So before we talk to Brad, I just want to really encourage our listeners to leave us an iTunes review. It really helps us a ton, more than you guys can imagine. I know we harp on it a lot. I personally have never left an iTunes review of anything. Have you?
I don't think I have.
So we are giant hypocrites, but let's pledge that we will each go leave an iTunes review somewhere.
I solemnly pledge.
To not be hypocrites. Yeah. So we will leave our own reviews just to prove that it's doable. But if you guys could please just let us know, just say, hey, great shipping item as promised, or, you know, we hate this podcast, or check out my short film.
All are totally fine.
Yeah.
And much appreciated.
Yeah. So the more reviews just kind of helps us get found by other people.
Hey, one quick note before we get started with Brad. We have our live show coming up in Culver City, January 10th, Just Shoot It Live. We're going to have a ton of great guests, witty banter, all the fun that you come to expect, and then also a Q&A afterwards, and then a mixer where you can hang out, have a little bit of food, have a little bit of drink, and connect with the Just Shoot It community. It's going to be a great time. We can't wait to see you all. So if you're in the greater Los Angeles area, January 10th in Culver City, if you go to justshootitpod.com/live show, you can get more information. We do have a limited number of seats, but the tickets are free. So check out justshootitpod.com/live show to learn more. See you then. Thanks, everyone. Bye.
So, Brad.
Yes.
We're here. Thanks for coming to talk to us.
Thanks, man. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So you have directed a few movies.
Yep.
You did San Andreas.
I did.
I watched it last night.
Sweet. Me too.
Did you really?
No.
Do you go to bed every night? He's like, yeah.
I guess he wants to impress himself right now.
Do you watch your own movies like once they're out?
No, not really. I mean,
like it's on TBS. You're flipping through channels.
You know what? It's funny. I literally, San Andreas was on some like TNT or something.
Sure.
And I used to watch TNT and be like, man, I can't wait to make a movie that plays on TNT. You know, like they have like those like National Treasure movies. I'm like, man, those guys must make so much money. Their movies are on
checks,
TNT.
Man.
Yeah. And the other day I was like flipping through it and I was like, San Andreas. And I recorded it. Never watched it. But I was just like, oh my God, like I get to record my own movie on TNT.
I mean, that is cool, right?
I don't know why it's cool to me, but it's definitely like, it's sort of a reflective moment because on a, so many levels, I still feel like a fan. Like, I don't feel like the Hollywood, like I'm a Hollywood director, and I don't feel that way a lot of times. So when I have those moments, I record it, but like, I will never watch that. Right. I haven't watched San Andreas since I saw it at the premiere. The thing with the movies that I make is that I watch them like 4,000 times trying to finish them because of all the visual effects and all that stuff. It's not like I get to like shoot it, cut it, put some music on it, and be like, all right, here we go. So I have to watch my movies like, I'm not joking, like I've seen Rampage like, I don't know, 150 times right now.
Do you think you've seen it more than someone making like a drama or a comedy?
I guarantee seen their movie? It. Oh, yeah. I have to. There's no choice. I have to like iteration upon iteration upon iteration. Like for example, today I was talking to Bob Desay, who's my editor, and Bob just came off of this little movie called Star Wars, mm-hmm. The Last Jedi. He edited that. And
well, he's done now. The Last Jedi. There can't be more.
That's right. So, it's over. Yeah. Sorry, guys. You screwed this one up.
Yeah.
But you know, he was like, we're talking about screens inside of shots inside of Rampage. And there is 150 shots of monitors that we have to comp with 240 elements that we have to build.
Right.
That's just, we're talking about screens in the background of scenes. Like, I can't, if you're shooting a rom-com, you're not going to do that. Why would you ever spend the money on that stuff, you know? You're going to, like, fix, I don't know, Matthew McConaughey's suits or something, you know?
Right. Like, yeah, I was wondering last night when I was watching San Andreas, like, if there's a shot, like an overhead shot of like a huge dust cloud and a helicopter and like a building, like in the bottom right corner, like how anal are you about a shot like that? Do you go in there and you're like, can we just move the helicopter to the left? Like
crazy anal about all of it. All of it. Like it's at the end of the day, it's all composition. You know, whether I'm shooting a tabletop of a can or I'm shooting a helicopter in the middle of an intersection, it's all composition. You know, it's the same thing, really, except mine, one costs way more money
right.
and is a little more violent. But, you know, it comes down to, like, realism, composition, impact within the cuts. So, like, to go from, like, a close-up of Dwayne to this high-wide of something like that, you're designing all that stuff to get some sort of emotional impact. So you're anal about all of it. And with visual effects in particular, I'm pretty strict. Like I shoot plates for everything. So like people will go like, oh, it's a big VFX shot. But like that shot that you're talking about, there's a plate that's underneath that shot of that real location that we then add a destruction to. And a lot of times what will happen is it'll become like an 80%, they'll call it like an 80% digital shot where they rebuild all the buildings. But the reason it looks good is because I shot the shot and then I can A-B it with the real thing and the VFX company can A-B it with the real thing. Like on Rampage, we're having this thing now where I'm getting really perturbed by fake-looking forests. And so I've like, and I've worked with the same VFX guy for a while, this guy named Colin Strauss, who actually is a director. He did like a Skyline and a Alien versus Predator Requiem. Oh, and I'll be like, Colin, you're using one of those goddamn forest plates. I don't want to see bullshit for it. You know, because you see it and you're like, that's not real. It doesn't feel real. I'm being taken out of this thing and I don't want to be taken out. And so you're anal about all of that stuff, you know, like, trust me, I wish there was a like do it awesome button that you could press and all the VFX would be amazing, but it is the complete and total opposite. We have like hundreds of iterations of shots.
And you're that anal about like the leaves in the forest. Do you ever use VFX like on a performance? Like you're like, oh, I wish he was just smiling a little bit more. I mean, you're already in this pipeline of VFX.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think the closest thing that you'll hear of with that is touch-ups for people. Like you'll hear like a blemish or a scar or something.
But like Fincher will like split
tears.
Screen.
People will add tears sometimes as well. Right?
Yeah, I've done that.
Yeah.
Tears for continuity is a thing I had a problem with. Like the performance was there, but then I wanted to cut over to someone else and there was no tear. And so I've had to add continuity tear, you know?
Sure.
Fincher uses split screens.
Yeah.
Here's a secret. Everybody uses split screens.
Sure.
Everybody uses them. They're like, there are hundreds in San Andreas. You just won't know because that's where we're at with editing. There's like nothing is sacred visually, you know, like you can do so much. It's a little scary, actually. I thought I was a genius when I directed. I was like, man, the continuity is amazing. Because like I'm super detailed and super anal about all the, you know, when someone reaches here, I want to be on this shot. So I need to be in the over, you know, like I plan all of that stuff. And I thought, I was like, wow, I nailed it. And then, you know, Bob, my editor, was just like, yeah, no, that's a split. Oh, yeah, that's a split there. And you're like, what?
Oh, just in terms of timing. So your editor is like partially directing the performance as well with those split screens.
Yeah, it's not the emotion stuff. It's more of the continuity direction. Mm-hmm. You know, they're trying to harness the pacing and the continuity right. of performance more than they're really doing performance.
Right. But, you guys have picked the take you like, and then he's crafting something around
absolutely,
it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And sometimes you'll get like the closest thing to actually crafting performance, I would say, is ADR, which is like you can notch up and down performance substantially. Now, like, honestly, in order to redo someone's performance through an entire movie, like, that's an insane amount of time and work, and you would never really do that.
With ADR?
Yeah. Though, you know, I hear ADR. When I go to movies, I don't know if you guys...
Yeah, for sure. Okay. Even Law and Order, you're like, why are we on her back for the most important line of the scene?
Totally. I mean, with, like, big movies, there's...
Even Wonder Woman, there's, like, all this exposition when they're riding the horses, and we're just on their back the whole time. And I'm like, okay.
There's a lot. And I have a... Since I was like a little kid, I used to just call them fake lines. I could hear like the fake lines. I could hear like, why are they talking about how many hours are left on this shot? You know, like, but it was the quality of the record. And so I have like a really strong aversion to ADR because it takes me out just for myself. So in my own films, I try to like be really, really strict with it and, you know, talk to the mixers and be like, you're only using ADR if you absolutely have to. And I have like a really, you know, I have a really good editing team. And so I'm always just like, why are we using that? Why did we ADR that? And a lot of times it'll be a safety net, you know, for like if there's
or
bumps.
I feel like it's those guys that need to do the separate mixes for international, mm-hmm. right? They need the dialogue separated from
TV
the
TV mix. We do that for swear words, like even like shit. You can't say shit on television. So you'll get like, we'll bring in like Jeffrey had to come in and do shoot for, you know, there's like 50 shits in Rampage and he had to do shoot for 50 times or whatever.
Have you ever used sound-alikes, like the Rock sound-alike or a,
you know? No, I would, you know, especially for like previews or something like that, because the problem with
which
like,
that's a Canadian for trailers, right?
No, a preview for like testing the movie.
Sorry. I was going to say, I grew
but it
up
is
calling
Canadian
them,
for tra-
I call it a, called them previews when I was a kid as well.
Oh, yeah,
really? Like the Northern California.
Yeah. But no, I mean like for testing the movie, because the thing is like you go to test the movie and Dwayne's so busy. Sometimes mm-hmm. it's so hard and like you might have 100 ADR lines and some of them are just like bumps and noise. On my movies, it tends like fans. There's just fans for wind and dust and like, you know,
right.
So every single one of his lines is like in the background. And you're like, oh my God, please God. So we like, the sooner you get them in, the more you can just clean the movie out and kind of like be like, okay, this is done. Like we're done here. But I would use a sound alike if I could, but you know,
right.
He's busy. No one really sounds like the Rock and you know,
I imagine there's probably contractual things as well. Right.
Well, like, ultimately like to finish the movie, there is, you can't really like, I mean, maybe if he said, yeah, it's okay, but I wouldn't want that because you're getting what he does is the special quality, you know?
Right.
But yeah, there is none. Trust me. We've looked,
I think I told him, didn't we talk about it last time? I have a friend that edits like big movie trailers and they always use sound alikes because he'll say like, you won't believe how many movies don't have one line in the movie that tells you what the movie's about.
Right.
And they need that line. So they use like the guy that sounds like Eddie Murphy, you know, and the guy that sounds like,
we just get, whoever. Dwayne will do it. Like he'll talk into his phone and send it to us for doing the trailer, you know, and then we'll go, okay, great. Well, if he's usually, see, the thing is he works so much, he's usually on set.
Right.
So we just get the sound recorders of that movie to get the lines for us. And then they send it over to WB and they put it in. But
yeah. I want to go back to the VFX stuff for just a quick second, because I want to learn a little bit more about how you note things, right? Like, so are you, when you say you're watching this movie like so many times, are you in a screening room?
Yeah.
And then, okay, so like you realize, oh, I want to tweak something.
You want me to walk
something.
You through my average day right now in this
well,
movie?
Well, actually,
specifically with noting, I want to know, like, are you there with a laser pointer? Are you walking over to a monitor? Like, how do you do it? Because I know how to do it on like over my buddy's shoulder, like in a post house.
Okay.
But like on a feature like this.
It's probably not that different.
Yeah.
So like on the movie right now where I'm at, every day is one of two things.
Music, this is Rampage.
This is Rampage, yeah. Music.
Which is based on the video game.
Based on the video game, yeah. It's either music or visual effects at this point. I will usually spend the mornings with my composer. who I've done a bunch of movies with, so it's great. He has a pool, and it's amazing. And then I'll go in the afternoon, and I'll go into the doldrums of visual effects. No, I'm kidding. We go into a screening room that we have on the Warner Brothers lot that's just for us, just for the movie. And they have up on all their walls a little snapshot of every single shot that digitally is going to be touched. And right now it's like 1,400 shots or something like that. And I go in ahead of everybody. This isn't normal, but what I do is I go in ahead of everybody and I watch a string out. I just watch every single shot we're going to talk about today just played back to back to back. So I'll sit there by myself with one of the VFX editors. He's just there to hit pause, play. And if there's... And every single... The way you can watch the shot is you can either put the mat on it and just see it like it's in the movie, mm-hmm. or you can pull the mat off and you can see all of the information, the lenses, the ID numbers, all that stuff. So a lot of times I'll be asked... And he can see all of it back there. He has a couple monitors. He's behind me and there's like a couple couches and then a desk. And at the desk is the editor who's running the machine, a couple of VFX assistants. And then on the couches are usually me, my two editors... Sometimes a VFX producer when he wants to cry about how much money we're spending, and then VFX supervisor Colin. And I go through before they come into the room and I watch everything. And that's really for me, I'm a very, very heavy prepper. Like I was saying about having the continuity and, you know, thinking I had done such a great job, but really I hadn't, and Bob had saved my life. But I really kind of like prep everything. And it's to avoid, for me, being creative in pressure situations is about prep. Mm-hmm. I need to de-stress every situation so that I can think freely. And I go in and look at everything, and I'm really just flagging issues that I can see coming. This shot's not going to work. Mm-hmm. This thing. Because what happens is...
You're not watching them how they are in the edit. You're just watching them on their own?
Just on their own. But I've seen the movie so much. And when we do review, so then when they do come in, we actually review the shot now in context. Mm-hmm. I've asked for a string out for me. And that's simply because I don't have any time in my day. So I just need to see it as fast as I can see it. So I'll watch it and say, you know, 150 shots. That could be 22 minutes of footage. So I'm just watching 22 minutes of raw shots. Now, when they come in the room, they're going to... no sound, no. When they come in the room, they'll hit play on the scene, and they'll be, and someone, one of the assistants will be, okay, it's FS 1345, and you're watching, and they'll go this one, because some shots are fast, and some shots are, you're trying to just watch, you know? And I'm watching, and then once we see it through, and they'll call up, okay, blocking approval on the animation of this, da 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 da. And then you'll watch it and I'll go, okay, am I looking for facial expression as well as physical expression? Right. It depends on where you're at in the process. And they'll kind of walk you through. And we're working with Weta, which is Peter Jackson's company. And they're very, very high caliber. So it's interesting because even though I'll be like, all right, on frame 10, 11, I want George to hit this car. And then when he gets to frame 14, whatever, he jumps over this fence, right? That's not real. He doesn't jump over a fence, but he does hit a car. But so, you know, it's one of those things where they'll send it back. And sometimes it'll be nothing like that. But then they'll give this explanation like, you know, we thought that with the camera speed and blah, 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 this might work better. And so they're being super creative and they're giving rationale. And I actually wasn't used to that because I've never worked with Weta before. They're coming to the table like I know from animation, like artists, like really kind of like pushing ideas. And sometimes I just want to go in there and see this stuff before I sit down in a room with five very opinionated people sure. who've made right. 20 times more films than me to tell me what they like. Well, I want to know what I like. Mm-hmm. And so I have to sit there and kind of watch it and think about it, especially as I'm getting new stuff thrown at me.
Mm-hmm. Is that something that you've learned over time? Like in the beginning, you would kind of like... be like, well, this guy's made 20 films, so he must be right. And this guy's telling me it's way cheaper to do this.
I've never been like that. I've been stubborn my entire life. It's just more of a social awkwardness for me. I don't like the normal human behavior that comes with people who have opinions. I don't mind opinions. It's just all of the other things that come with it that I find uncomfortable, you know, like someone has to feel like they're proving something or, you know, all the ego. Or
rationalize their job.
Yeah, I don't really have any of that hang up. I really don't. Like, I don't care. Like, I'm like, where's the finish line? How do we make it awesome? Period. And The only hang up I have is that sometimes it takes me longer to digest other people's ideas than my own. And I'm super aware of that. So I go in ahead of time, you know, like I've adjusted all my behavior to factor into how I operate, you know? And, you know, at the end of the day, I think people who care about making films, they put everything second to the film. And like, to me, that's the sign of a good filmmaker is that everything is second. Everything.
Including your ego or your hangups or your...
Or my health or anything, you know, like you end up like you, everything goes out the window except for the movie. And you, it's almost like an uncontrollable thing. You just, I never think about this until now that you're making me think about it. But like, you know, I don't ever like really...
Your therapist asked us.
Yeah, exactly. Like, what is wrong today?
Sure. Well, this is the beginning of your indie movie, basically.
Yeah, exactly.
Wait, so I want to, I'm like dying to know just like how you approach making a shot list. But I think for the sake of our listeners, if we can just rewind... Again, I think a large portion of our audience is like your job is their dream job, and they would love to know how you got here.
I think it's safe to say 100% of our audience.
Like I wouldn't mind directing. Well, I'd love to direct like Marvel movies, but I kind of feel like that's probably something that you've been in consideration for.
I'm going to go to Marvel next week.
Oh, hey. Cool. Yeah.
Well, we'll put in a good word for you.
Yeah.
Oh, please do. Yeah.
I mean, there's like the Ryan Coogler way, you know, you make Fruitvale Station, then you make, you write a movie for Sylvester Stallone, and then you get to make, you know, Black Panther. And I think Fruitvale Station's like a Sundance film, maybe. There's like the Wes Ball who made Maze Runner, you know, he made just an amazing short film. So what's your path? How did you get here?
I made a short film that did really well in Canada at a film school called the CFC.
And was it like a VFX driven short film?
No,
or action
not at all.
Anything?
No, it was called Evelyn, the Cutest Evil Dead Girl. And it was about a little dead girl that tried to kill herself back to life in order to make friends. So it was like a very kind of Tim Burton-y, dark comedy. And I built it all out of cardboard and wood.
Like stop motion.
No, I used real people, but made them act like they were animated.
Wait, so like those Duracell commercials back in the day where the people wore foam costumes?
No, it was real people, but they were dressed in like very simple, like Fisher-Price costumes, and they walked around and acted like they were animated. And they were grown women acting as little kids, and I built the sets really big.
Like forced perspective kind
of. The whole thing was forced perspective. The entire thing was like a pop-up book. Like it was literally like cardboard and literally cardboard and wood. And it was my thesis film at the CFC, and Tom Hanks saw it, and David Heyman, who produced Harry Potter, saw it.
And how did they see it?
It went and did the festival circuit, and it did really well. It was probably more commercial than most, you know, films on the festival circuit. And David was a really kind and flew me to New York, which, you know, I was like a super poor student. And Tom Hanks and Playtone, I think, flew me to L.A.
So those are two totally separate meetings.
Yeah, separate things. But they happened within like the same 2 weeks, which to me was...
Did you premiere at like Toronto Film Festival or something big like that?
I probably did actually at Toronto. And then, but I mean, I went around the world with it. I got to travel the world. And then basically as a Canadian independent filmmaker, I had zero expectations about being a Hollywood filmmaker. It's not really in the cards for anybody. At least you don't think it is, you know. To the point when I sold a script in Hollywood and I told friends of mine in Toronto, they thought I was lying. They were like literally calling bullshit on me. And I was like, no, man, I did. I sold the script to Sony. And they're like, no, you didn't. And I was like, no, I did. Like, no one would believe me. And it's just because no one was really doing it, you know. But I basically, growing up there where it's not a Hollywood system, so there's no real like, I'm going to be a writer and the studio's going to hire me and then a director's going to come on. You have to write for yourself if you want to be a director. That's why there's like the Adam Egoyans exist, you know, these guys that direct and write their own stuff, because that is what the system is there. So I came in as a writer-director, and then I could only get writing jobs. Mm-hmm. So I ended up writing for Universal. I wrote an animated film for Tom Hanks' company. I sold a script to Sony the year after.
And how you just learned to write from writing your own stuff and writing at school.
So. Yeah. I mean, I'm like the classic guy. Like I got a scholarship to go to university. It wasn't a big scholarship, but I got out of my small town, which was like 9,000 people in Newfoundland, which is a super small province in Canada. And I stopped going to class after like 2 months because I was just like, this is...
Right, like I might as well shoot it instead of
I had this thing where I realized, like, because I didn't grow up with money, so I was like, I'd saved all my money to go to university, and then I'd gotten there, and, you know, for some people, like $10,000 isn't much money, and for me, it was everything that I had.
Right.
And I was...
In a very literal sense.
Yeah, absolutely. In a total literal sense, and... you know, I was sitting there going, oh my God, I'm spending all the money I've ever saved after having two jobs all through high school, you know? And then I was like, I had this like moment where I realized I have to make the decision. I was lucky because there was no, in a way I was lucky because there was no opportunity for a B plan. There was no like backup plan. And there was never a backup plan out of so many reasons. I literally asked myself this question, like, what could you do at 25, 35, 45, 55, 65 that would make you happy? And the only answer I could come up with was filmmaker. And so I was like, if that's the truth, and it felt like the truth at the time, like inside, I was like, then that is what I have to attempt to do. And so then I dropped out of university, told my parents what I was doing. They were like ready to murder me. And I said, just give me 5 years. Give me 5 years to become a filmmaker. And if it doesn't work in 5 years, I'll do whatever you want me to do. I'll go back to university, whatever you want me to do. You know, and they kind of were like, well, you should take classes. And I was like, okay, I'll try to get into the film school in Canada. I'm not going to say the film school. I went there. I got in. After 2 months, I asked for my money back because it was bullshit. And I was like, this is no good. You're not teaching me how to make films. Every time I have an idea on how to make a film, you tell me, no, this is an exercise about whatever the fuck, jump cuts, or, you know, I'm like, right. Why can't I do a film that's narrative and also about jump cuts? No, we're not doing narrative films.
I've noticed Brad has very few jump cuts.
Loves I never continuity. Do jump cuts. I'm still angry at that professor. But so it was just, I then just had to figure it out on my own because no system was supportive of someone who knew what they wanted to do and had their own impatience and their own timeline in their mind. And remember, like, I'm like every other, most likely, I'm like every other successful filmmaker that you guys have ever talked to. Like, I knew Spielberg had made his first movie when he was 25. I know all the facts that everyone else knows because I read all those books when I was 17. I'm now 19 or 18, and I'm at this film school, and they're telling me to learn about fucking sound waves. And I'm like, give me my money back, man. Like, I don't want to learn about sound waves. I want to go make a film, you know? And, like, I've read all this other crap that you're trying to teach me, like... I did that on my own. So I just got into a place in this mindset where it was like, I'm going to go figure this stuff out. There's no better proof than to go do it. You know, I asked a famous filmmaker when I was really young.
To just shoot it, even?
To just shoot it. Hey, like I asked a famous filmmaker when I was young, I was like, how do you become a director? And he says, you go direct. Right. And I was like, okay, then.
Which is a lot harder than, like, you know, writers say to be a writer, you have to write, which is pretty easy to do on your own.
That's
but
true.
Direct... It but, takes you know, a little more manipulating.
But it's true, but you will find a way. It's like everything else, right? Like, you'll figure it out, like, because you have to figure it out, you know? So and then the short answer to this question is really, like, I dropped out of a bunch of film schools, made a short film. That got me into a specialty film school called the CFC, where I made this short film that people in Hollywood saw. Then I went through the whole meet agents, meet lawyers, all that stuff. And then I just started writing because I couldn't get a job as a director. And then,
right. So even after you met Tom Hanks and the producer of Harry Potter, you still, nobody hired you to direct.
No, what was interesting is that, and I'm not sure I've told anyone the story, but, they talked to me about Harry Potter and I was like, hell no.
Wait, was this before the first Harry Potter?
Yeah.
Oh,
they flew me to Manhattan and I had lunch with them to talk about Harry Potter. And I was like, I was so not ready. And I knew I wasn't ready. I was like, I'm not fucking Harry Potter up. There's not a chance I'm directing. Now, he didn't offer me.
Had you read the book?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And it was like, you know, it was a sensation or whatever. And I'm not saying he offered me Harry Potter, but they were, what do you think about Harry Potter and this? And I was like, oh, no. No, I can't.
That's how Wes Ball got Maze Runner. He came, he was pitching his movie. He did that short. And they're like, have you read The Maze Runner? And he's like, I'll read it. And he read it that night, like the whole book. And then the next day he's like, I mean, I guess this is how I would make it. And they're like, done. Your movie's like on hold. Let's do this.
Oh, really?
Yeah. That's so, but yeah, it's crazy how that stuff comes up, you know?
Oh yeah. No, I think that you do what you do and then life does what it does. And like, I could never predicted my career. Like, and there's so much stuff that is so out of your control. And there's so many other people making decisions on your behalf that, you know, there's all these opportunities that come up that, you know, that can go one way or another. So a lot of it was just, you know, luck or like working hard and being in the right place because you're willing to do 4 extra meetings that no one else is willing to do or whatever.
But I guess Matt and I were talking about this yesterday about like this lottery ticket idea, you know, of like, oh, you got the lottery tickets. You got into the system and you got to do these giant movies. Right. But then you probably don't look at it as a lottery ticket. You look at it as like you bought like 100 lottery tickets and finally, right?
Yeah, 1,000 lottery tickets.
Yeah, 1,000. Yeah. Yeah.
So exactly. Did you make any bad shorts before you made this award-winning short?
No, I'd only made 2. The difference for me was, as opposed to maybe other people, was I was going for like truly, I would say to people, like, I want to take such big steps, I know I'm going to like blow a hamstring. You know, like I was like going from a $12,000 short film, and I put everything I had, like it was like hyper focused,
like you weren't afraid to risk everything, is what it sounds like.
No, I was literally risking everything all the time. So I was literally going all in.
Like
all
you weren't hedging bets or saying like, oh, well, this is too expensive.
No, because
let's do
remember
a small
I was
version.
Saying like I had no money or all that. Like if I failed, then I'm totally screwed. So I can't fail, you know, like I wasn't like willing to like risk it all in the sense of like, well, who knows if this is going to work? It's like, no, this is going to work. Like this has to work, you know, or I'm done and I've got nothing, you know, and I got nowhere to go and nothing to do and no money. And, you know, so I was kind of just pushing all in on everything. So I didn't make a bunch of stuff that no one saw or didn't really work. I made little things on my own with a video camera just to like kind of test ideas. And I used to draw all the time and paint all the time. And like, I was always a visual person. So I'd be always making notes and ideas and like shot ideas and stuff like that.
And would you like pitch stuff to people and see how they reacted? Like, were you kind of testing out stories and things like that?
No, but I used to just be I was the friend who would tell everybody stories all the time. Like, you know, I was also like friends of mine from when I was really little, like living in Newfoundland. When we were kids, we used to play guns. This is what we called it, play guns. And I used to live... I didn't actually grow up in a small town. I grew up on a highway outside of a small town. So I like... It was just forest, you know, around me. And my friends
That's
used
why
to,
you have such a keen eye for was, forests.
Yeah, I know. Like, guys, don't screw with my forests, man. I know my shit. They used to like ride out to my house on their bikes, and we used to like play guns. And later, as I became a filmmaker, my friends they reminded me that I used to direct them as kids. Like, I used to tell them where the bad guys were. And I'd be like, you've been hit. And they'd be like, oh my God, I'm shot. And I'm like, no, not in your arm, your stomach. Oh my God.
Just a little faster this time. Cool.
Yeah. Yeah. I wouldn't call more takes, but it was like, I'd tell them where to go and like how fast to go. And
right.
Like,
how the fight was kind of blocked.
Yeah. I was like blocking out the action or whatever. So, yeah.
Yeah. I used to be like the dungeon master.
I was a DM too.
Yeah. Like, and I never really connected it to like a world building until like 20 years later.
But I'm dying to know how you got that first directing gig. So you were writing, right? You're writing full time.
And were you writing like kind of big blockbuster type films?
I basically. I mean, first one was animated, and the second one was like comparable to like an Edward Scissorhands. So not like full of explosions, but like more of a romantic. Yeah, like exactly, like a fairy tale, like heightened stuff. The first one was just totally like random, honestly. The whole thing is bizarre, but I was basically in the producer's office looking at his posters that he'd made, and there was a Cats and Dogs poster. Mm-hmm. And he pitched me these things, which I didn't like any of the things he pitched me. And I was like, man, like I don't want to make any of the stuff he's talking about.
He was pitching you to write or to direct?
I think to direct. He was pitching me ideas he had, like scripts he had. And as I was leaving, I said, if you ever decide to make a sequel for that, call me. And like 6 months later, he called me. And he just said, I will back you as the filmmaker if you want to do it, period.
For Cats and Dogs?
Cats and Dogs 2. And I was like, really? And he was like, yep, I want you to come in and we'll interview writers and we'll come up with a take. The studio's interested in doing this. And so we brought in like a bunch of writers and I heard all these takes. And the best thing about that process was before there was a script, they gave me 3 or 4 storyboard artists, 2 concept artists, and they gave me a room in Warner Brothers, and I could just come up with visual sequences. And the visual sequences were, the studio kept saying, well, he's elevating. Everything that we're seeing is better than what we pictured, you know? Mm-hmm. The thing I wasn't good at was harnessing the script to do that. And I was too nice. I wasn't pushing like, this is what it has to be. It has to be this, you know? I was kind of like trying to like...
Right, you were so grateful that you had the job.
I couldn't believe I had the job, you know? So I definitely made this mistake of trying to like appease everybody. And in a way, I didn't really appease myself. Mm-hmm. And I actually came out of that process feeling very grateful. You know, a lot of people said, like, why would you do this? Why would you make Cats and Dogs 2 as your first movie? And they don't realize, like, I have no money. I'm like,
It's a studio film.
Sure.
I'm also 24 and broke and poor and, like, living in a friend's spare room in West Hollywood with my then girlfriend at the time. I can't afford to do anything. Like, I don't have hobbies because I have no money. Like, I'm like drawing all day and like
watching. So it wasn't because you love dogs?
Well, I do love dogs and I had a cat, but you know, it was like, no, man, like I'm a filmmaker and no one's giving me a shot to be a filmmaker and they're giving me a shot to be a filmmaker and I'm young and I'm like, how could I say no to this?
Well, and also I imagine the VFX in that movie really set you up for the rest of your career. Right. Mm-hmm. Like you do a ton of VFX driven movies, as we've been talking about. So it's like that's a short list of people who can really handle that sort of workload.
Yeah. I mean, people say that to me now. They're like, you know, you're on a very short list of filmmakers that can handle what you do well.
Yeah.
And I actually kind of credit it to animation because I started in animation.
Interesting.
And yeah. So I got used to talking to animators and studying conceptually ideas frame by frame.
I'm curious about that. Like, so how do you, there's no script. How do you come up with ideas of what to do with these cats and dogs? Like with your storyboard artist,
just like sequences that I thought would be cool and like, stuff
like what, can you give us an example?
Like how a dog could be out on the street being walked and still communicate with like a secret base. Mm-hmm. And it would be at like a fire hydrant. So he'd be tending to be peeing at a fire hydrant. And then he'd actually be like
talking into a walkie,
talking it into a walkie-talkie, yeah. And then you'd follow it down and see where the base is underground. Like it was just stuff like that. It was very animation oriented. I kind of studied like what would people expect to see, and then how would I flip all of that, you know?
Right.
I think the best stuff probably didn't make it in the movie because then. Honestly, there had to be a plot and all, you know, like there are all these things that you then had to do that had nothing to do with this one-off sequence. But if I had my time back, I would have stuck to my guns on certain sequences.
Right. And so you were kind of coming up with set pieces and then working them backwards into the script.
Yeah. And I should have stuck closer to what I came up with, honestly.
Wow. So then what was after that? Journey?
Yeah. Cats and Dogs 2. And then, Journey 2, which, you know.
And that was where you met. The Rock.
Yeah, that's where I met Dwayne. And so to fill in the gap here, like Cats and Dogs 2 did not make a lot of money. It wasn't a success. You know, I remember reading, I mean, this is like so bad. I hope critics are, I mean, they write stuff like, you know, your film is like setting back film history 100. they write this stuff and you're like, really, really, my film is set like,
sure. You know, Cats and Dogs 2, guys.
Yeah,
come on.
They're like literally, you know. Like, you know,
have you seen Beverly Hills Chihuahua 2?
Yeah, I'm like, it's just is like a little harsh, you know. Right. Like, I never expected them to like.
I mean, it's a family movie, right?
Yeah,
like the families to go see the movie probably had a great time.
And I worked my ass off to make it. Yeah. You know, like I didn't like just go cool. No, do a thing with the Chihuahua. Like I was like, I'm trying my best here.
Yeah, right. I love the idea of like lazy filmmaking. Like when people are like, oh, a huge studio movie is lazy. It's like, no, like there's thousons of people working on this.
They literally just discredited
so
themselves.
Hard. Yeah.
They just discredited themselves. Yeah. But anyway, my point was after making Cats and Dogs 2, and feeling kind of pummeled, you know, like I did my best and I honestly like was at Warner Brothers as like a 24, 25 year old kid, like, what is happening? Like, how, you know, it was an $80 million movie. I made two short films.
Yeah.
It was $80 million.
Pretty insane.
Yes.
And did nobody say, like, guys, why are you letting this guy direct this movie?
No, because I was proving them that I could, right? Every step of the way. I mean, I was literally crapping myself all the time, you know, because I was like really shy, really nervous, way in over my head. But I would like stand there outside before I would go in and sit in front of 10 executives and the president of Warner Brothers and present show reels for them and concept art and all this stuff. I'd never made a movie before. I never made an indie film. I mean, two short films. And I was like making it up as I'm going. Like,
right. But you also wrote some movies too.
I wrote two scripts.
Features, right?
Yeah, two feature scripts that never got made.
But were sold.
Absolutely were sold, yep. That is not the same as selling.
Sure.
No, but if a studio buys a script, it can't be that bad, right? I mean,
no, but less, you want to talk about the commerce of these two things. One cost them $250,000 and one cost them $80 million. So let's just weigh those
in terms
two
of how much they're spending. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's like, it has, besides the fact that like I write a script and I give it to an agent and they get it to a producer and that producer sells it. And so what am I doing? I'm sitting home drinking hot chocolate or whatever the fuck I'm doing. You know, like the other one is, skinny, nervous kid who's never made anything is standing at Warner Brothers in a screening room with the president of Warner Brothers, the 10 executives, and going, excuse me, this is what I want to do, and like, look at my show. Like, you're crapping yourself, right? Because you've never done this on any level. So you're sitting there going, oh, my God. So then I go through all that. I then get destroyed by the critics. I don't make enough money. And then I feel completely and totally cheated as a filmmaker. I'm like, I've worked my entire life. I'm not like a hack. I worked so hard on this movie and I've not won on any level. No one is impressed by this, right? Like, no, my parents are like, wow, congratulations, you know? But I'm not saying that to myself. I'm not, some of my friends aren't saying that to me.
Well,
no,
we would have been impressed.
Well, thank you. I wish I knew you back then. It would have been a lot easier.
Sure, yeah.
But so I go into Journey 2 going like, I'm going to prove
that. But so how do you get Journey 2?
Yeah.
So Warner Brothers knew there's good people at that studio, and there have been for a long time, and they knew that I worked hard. They knew that I didn't take a playoff. They just saw that. It was so clear that it was like I had a bunch of issues on that movie. Some of them are fair, some of them are not fair, some of them are me, some of them are not me. At the end of the day, it's all me, and that's what that's what people say, and that's, you get right. The good and the bad as a filmmaker. But so I had a good thing, like they knew that I'd worked my ass off for them and they were proud of the movie. And I got Journey 2 and like, of course, you make Cats and Dogs 2. The last thing you're looking for is another sequel.
Right.
I can't help what I was getting sent. And it wasn't submitted to me. It was just floating around through agencies.
Oh, interesting.
But I knew, I read the script and I knew how to do it. And I was like, I know how to do this. Hmm. And
like how you were just reading it and you were visualizing it while you were reading it?
Yeah. I was like, literally like, oh, I know how to do this. I know how to do this. I know how I would cast this character. I know how I would design this character. And
you felt like you had a unique take on it?
Well, I thought I had the right take on it. I don't know if it's unique, but I know what I wanted to do with it. And I then, you know, took my own initiative to go and make a big, huge lookbook. I did story reels on my own. Mm-hmm. I paid for all of it.
What's a story reel?
Like previs, but with storyboards. So I'd have a board artist board it, and then I would cut it so it would just dissolve through the boards.
So you hired someone?
Yeah, I paid out of pocket. I found people to do concept art for me.
And did you have actors voicing things or?
No, I just put text on the bottom. So, and then we left it up a little longer so you could just read it. I didn't have a massive budget. Come on.
Sure.
But no, there's music and sound effects and other things.
Yeah. And then I did the biggest thing was I did key art for all the sequences. So like when I was in the pitch. I could flip through the book and
that's really interesting.
Talk about the sequences like chronologically. Mm-hmm. And I would design like all of the sets through taking stills from other movies and stuff. And what it allowed me to do is tell them the story of the movie visually. So I'd say, like, in the opening, you know, when you're in Sean's bedroom, this is how Sean's bedroom will be. And I'd talk them through
it. And was it like a picture from another movie, or did you Photoshop things or cut, like...
All of it, all of it. Most of it was collages from everything, but not necessarily other movies. I don't like doing that as much. I do it sometimes, or did it sometimes, but... The thing that you have to fight against with other movies is that they instantly see the other movie.
Right. So especially if there's actors in the frame and stuff, right?
Yeah, and I never really did that. Except for like with casting, I'd be like, I really want to cast like Michael Caine. I was like, this is how I picture this character, you know? And then I walk them through the entire movie, show them the kind of story reels. And
that's like a half hour thing?
Yeah, could be half hour, 45. I like to do it as fast as humanly possible because I'm so nervous, basically. And so I shoot through the movie, and at the very back it was, I would do it differently now, but I put all my casting stuff at the back so I can get through all the set pieces and everything.
Sorry, what would you do differently now? Would you put the cast up top or?
I would do it just like as they were introduced in the story, mm-hmm. I would just introduce them in
right.
the story.
So they can visualize.
Yeah.
So they're just with you the whole
thing. You're watching the movie basically in stills or whatever.
Probably. So how much time and money do you invest in this gamble?
Whatever it takes. No, I don't know. I
like a week of work or like a month of work?
2 to 3 weeks. Yeah. And I didn't have a job. So right. I was like sure. all the time.
And had you done that yeah. before on other movies that you didn't get?
I did it to sell my scripts.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, I see. Interesting.
Yeah. So it was like, I know that I'm like a mediocre writer, but look what it's going to look like. Right. And when you read my description, that's what you're going to see. And so they could visualize the script, you know? Right.
That's like Zach Braff. He would write like, had put songs like song sure. names before yeah. like various set pieces in Garden State just to get people like in the mood, right? To just like listen to that. Well, I think he sent it with like a CD or
yeah,
something.
Yeah, that's right. Sold a lot of CDs. Yeah. He put on the soundtrack for the movie basically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's how you got Journey 2.
Yeah. And then I had to go through all the steps of pitching everybody because my first movie didn't make any money.
And did you get the cast? Like, I mean, Matt and I have been through attaching cast, and it's, you know, it's really hard to prove to like famous people that they can trust you, right?
Yeah. Well, I'd done all this work to show the studio. So I just did that again, Dwayne specifically on Journey. And you know, the thing that got Dwayne on Journey, which it's interesting because it works a lot with, like, I've never done this again, but it works for me as well as it worked for him is, my now composer, Andrew Lockington, and I worked on the theme for the movie before we went to him. And so when I went to him, I played the composed theme, and he loved it. And he was just like, I remember what he literally was like listening to it, and he was nodding his head. He's like, it's a big movie, Brad. And I was just like, it is. It's a big movie. He's like, yeah, I like it. This is big.
Sure.
You know, like he didn't realize how big I was really trying to make it, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm.
And he only does big movies.
He only does big movies. And the score was like Indiana Jones.
Right.
Right. It was like a big, it was this big flourish. And I had the advantage, Andrew had done the score for the first movie. Mm-hmm. So we had talked through like my references for Mysterious Island or, you know, the stop motion animated Mysterious Island. And so we went back and like, listened to that initial score, and I had all these influences that I wanted to bring into the movie, and so we had like taken the best parts of that original score. But then, what's his name? Oh, Bernard Herrmann.
I love that. I feel like kind of the lesson to take from all this is like you know, when I've tried to attach people, we send them the script first, and then see if they'll take a meeting. But yeah. I feel like you. Just like, or like an onslaught of audio visuals. Like, here's how it looks. Here's how it looks.
Well, they read the script first. But like, you know, Dwayne, you know, he's told me this story now because like the movie did well and he was very happy with it and everything. But, you know, they got to the part where there were giant bees and they were like, come on. They threw the script down, you know, like, what the hell is this? But then when I got in the room with him and showed him images that I'd created of what it would look like to be on the bees, it was kind of like, oh, this is like cooler than I thought. Like, I'm sure you read that. Like, I don't necessarily first of all, I barely ever read the action in a script unless I've rewritten it with the writer, mm-hmm. because I'm just going to imagine it how I want to imagine it. And that has yielded me really good results because I'm not tied to the written word. Uh-huh. So like in those places, I don't remember what it said about riding bees. It just said some bullshit about riding bees and it was probably cheesy as all hell. And he probably read it and was like, throw this off the plane, you know?
Sure, sure. But so then, it's just like bee parts.
I remember that next. Script landed on me.
For me, yeah, it's like, funny. Yeah, bee flies here. And then, yeah. you know, and I'm like, yeah, whatever. Sure. I'll do that, you know, and
how, sorry, to, this is a tangent, but how do you get inspired to come up with like a bee writing sequence? Like, do you watch other movies and go like, this is like a chase sequence? And
no, I completely try to steer clear of other movies. So this is a weird thing that like no one would think. Like, I never thought I was going to be an action director. I never thought, oh, I'd be good at action. That's a discovery of mine. Like, as so, I'm kind of fortunate that like I thought I wanted to be like this Tim Burton-y, arty mm-hmm. kind of dark guy. And because I loved that. It was like my first big passion as a filmmaker. And then I tried to go make it and turns out I wasn't that good at it, mm-hmm. but I tried my best. And then I was like, man, like I just got to like listen to what I'm good at. And then, so I get Journey. It's like an adventure movie. And I'm like, oh, and it turns out I can make this and people enjoy it and it does really well. And in making Journey, and now remember, Cats and Dogs 2 is like, I'm shooting Cats and Dogs. How much can you do action-wise? It's really hard, sure. you know?
Right,
like,
yeah.
That's more of a medium for jokes, I think, mm-hmm. than anything else.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm not like the lightest human being. I'm not like, hey, you know, zingers all over the place and like fart jokes and stuff. Like, not. And I'm not judging that. I'm just saying that's what would have been great for that thing, right. like to really just shoot live animals. But then when I go and make Journey 2 and I'm like, oh man, like there was no B unit director on Journey 2. Mm-hmm. I directed, I don't even care if there's a credit on that movie. I didn't look because I directed everything on that movie.
Well, like, there was the B unit, right?
Hey, dad joke of the day.
Yeah, hey.
I did all the action. I was like, I shot everything. And so the discovery was, oh man, like I know action. Like I did, it was totally instinctual. Like it wasn't hard. And
so you just like close your eyes and picture like how the bees fly, or do you?
Yeah, and
I mean, you have
it.
To get inspired by something, right?
I imagine it, and then I draw it. I mean, my process with directing actors is to imagine being them and sensing where the camera should be and having an emotional reaction. Like, I try to, like, live in their place mm-hmm. in order to understand where the camera should be. And so I guess it's sort of like that. Like, I picture it, and I draw it, and I just go, that would be fucking awesome, man, if we did this, you know, and it goes slow motion here or whatever. I just draw it and, you know, try to just lose myself in it and not. And also, like, as I've gone on as a filmmaker, I've completely tried to separate myself from the mechanics of filmmaking. I think it's a terrible thing to
figure out like what type of crane would get this shot.
Yeah. Right? And I know there's filmmakers that really love that stuff, and I'm mm-hmm. curious about it, and I know cameras well and I know lenses well, but in terms of storytelling, what I've learned along the way is to not care about those things so that you can imagine things that you don't know how to do. Mm-hmm. And
oh, that's interesting.
And San Andreas was the big one for me. I literally, that was the one where I was like, I don't know how we're doing this.
Like, how insane is that shot in the building where you come in through the window and there's the earthquake going on? The
restaurant.
Yeah, and they go up to the roof all in one, at least it looked like one shot, you know?
It was two or three, but they're long takes, mm-hmm. Seam together pieces. And I'm talking about everything from up to the roof to collapsing and her waking up and coming out, right? Mm-hmm. When it collapsed, that was one piece. Then after the collapse is one piece, and all the way up to the collapse is one piece. So there's just two, it's just two seams. And well, we rehearsed it for like...
There's like that girl that falls into the fountain, you know?
Yeah.
Like just these real kind of random little pieces that seem mm-hmm. like so hard to get perfect, you know?
Yeah, we rehearsed it for a week, 5 days of rehearsals with the entire stunt team and all those extras rehearsed it. And then 2 days with my A unit camera operator and a Steadicam before we even walked onto that set.
And do you ever like, does the producer ever come and say like, you know, can't you just shoot this in three shots and it would be take us half as many days?
To their credit, no.
Really? So they are like, you want to do this in a one-er? Then let's go for killer. It.
That was one of my things at the very onset of saying I want to make the movie. So that shot, I wrote that shot and gave it to Carlton, who then really like did a much better job of writing it out. But the reason that I wrote that was because in my initial pitch, I was like, I want to do, like when I went in to pitch that movie, I said things like,
this is San Andreas.
Yeah, San Andreas. I said things like, I don't want to make just gigantic moments. I want to make little moments too. Because I'm not from California. And I said, the scariest thing for me about earthquakes is being in an underground parking garage. That was me being like, that's the scariest thing for me.
Right.
And being
there's
in my
so many layers between you and the world.
In an earthquake? This sounds like a terrible idea. You know, like, so that was me saying, I want to do these intimate moments. So the whole thing with Dario getting caught in the back of the car was literally me being like, this is an intimate, small moment, but it's going to be played on this epic scale. And that's going to literally be cutting with exteriors, big, wide mm-hmm. open exteriors of earthquakes.
Right, where so entire buildings are falling
yeah,
down.
Yeah, so I wanted all those juxtapositions. And that was one of my things, was making intimate moments. The other thing was doing I want to experience what it would be like inside of an earthquake and not cut, not mm-hmm. let the audience out of the experience. And so then that's where the restaurant came from. And
just a quick technical question. Is anything really shaking when you're shooting that?
Everything but the floor. Hmm. Yeah, because if people are like, absolutely, everything's in there shaking. So the whole set's stable, but all the tables and the chandeliers are all on shakers. So everything's moving at the same time, the tables and the chandeliers, but the floor is not moving.
Wow. What about the actors? Are they like bouncing?
No. The camera's Steadicam.
And is the camera of shake added in post?
Yeah. So I work with a guy named Steve Yedlin, was the DP of San Andreas. Yeah. And Steve
He's had a lot of big movies.
No, he hasn't. San Andreas was his first big movie.
Oh, really?
Yeah. His biggest movie before that was Looper.
Okay.
And then, man, I love Looper.
Yeah, it's a great movie. So, and he's a really good cinematographer. And his second big movie is Last Jedi. And Steve
I feel like I've seen his name a lot, but maybe small movies.
You watch good movies because he does all Rian Johnson's films.
Oh, yeah.
So he and Rian went to school together. And then Jaron, the guy who DP'd Rampage, was my B-unit DP on San Andreas because Rian and mm-hmm. Steve and Jaron all went to school together. And, but anyway, they're all crazy tech heads, like great. Like, so Steve literally built a program that would like shake the camera on any device we put it on. So if we put it on a crane or put it on a Steadicam, it would still have vibrations. He built a head.
Oh, so the camera was shaking.
The camera was shaking. And then what you can't do is high frequency shakes because it would shake the hell out of the camera and just break it, right?
Oh,
so like because
right.
earthquakes are super high frequency. So everything you see in the movie that's like kind of a floating shake mm-hmm. is in camera. And everything that suddenly vibrates fast is all done in post.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that whole thing was
everything. And you add all the motion blur in post for the high frequency shakes.
I don't think you'd need motion blur for high frequency, but if you did, you would add it. But like, yeah, I don't think it's that high frequency, but I think there's probably motion blur for digital elements. I actually add a lot of motion blur to things and take a lot of crispness off of visual effects, even when they say, no, this is technically correct, because it doesn't look right to me. Huh. I would rather it be slightly what they would call like a degraded image, not technically perfect. I do that 90% of my shots.
What do you mean by taking crispness off of it?
Well, like a digital shot, I think they look really hyper crisp and hyper real a lot of times. Mm-hmm. So I ask for more motion blur. Mm-hmm. I ask for blurred pixels. I ask for halation in the edges so that when light hits it, you can kind of see like
blooming
lighting and glow that's very organic, you know? And sometimes they'll be like, well, we've already put that in there. And I'm like, double it, add more, you know, like, because it doesn't feel real to my eye and it's, you know, it's makes them a little crazy, but I think it looks good. I mean, to me, I'm like, this is what sells the reality a lot of times. But so, yeah. So anyway, like when I went in and pitched for San Andreas, there was a bunch of things that I said, this is what I want to do. This is why I'm attracted to this. And the other one was, I think the death of the daughter was like a big thing for me. To me, that was like the linchpin of the entire movie. And it wasn't really there when I first came on. Things like that were just like, this is why I would want to do it, you know? And so they were fully, they loved that idea. Are you kidding? Like the guys over at New Line were like, this is awesome. Can you pull this off? And I was like, I hope so. Like, I feel like I can. In fact, that's the only time while shooting I ever got a call from, there's this executive over there I really like named Mike Disco. And he called me on set the day after, or like 2 days after I shot it, and said, like the day after, because he just watched the dailies, and he was like, he calls me. I'm on set shooting the building sinking scene. And he calls me on set, and it's weird. Like the producer, like the studio is on the phone for you. And I'm like, studio is on the phone. They never call. Like sure. They're very respectful. I really love working with them, and how they work is great. Cause once you start shooting, they just like let you shoot, you know, cause you've gone through the process. Mm-hmm. You've signed off on the script. You've done, right. For me, I've done my storyboards, my previs, and we've noted all
the homework
stuff.
Is done.
All the homework's done. I'm not hiding anything from you. Like, let's talk about it. Cause you know, you're going to shoot it. They're going to see it. So why are you hiding anything? You know, I'm not trying to push off anything.
And how many days do you shoot San Andreas?
San Andreas was 72. So like the day after I shot the restaurant, they called, and I walk off, or I got out of a wetsuit or whatever the hell I was in, and like went down and took the call. I was literally living in a wetsuit a week on that movie. It was ridiculous. Oh man,
just the realities of shooting for 72 days. Like
you want to punch yourself in the face after 2 weeks.
I'm just tired.
Did you do five day weeks?
Yeah, 5 and 6. It's like,
yeah, that's gnarly.
It's
insane.
Super gnarly. It's super. People don't really get it. It is mentally exhausting. You are wiped out. I was sick for months after San Andreas. Like, I didn't think I was going to get better. I was like...
You had, sea legs from all the shaking.
He calls, and he's just like... He says to me, man, that shot, the restaurant, it's amazing. And I said, Mike, all the shots I'm doing, I'm trying to make amazing. And he started laughing, and he's like, no, I just had to call you. I was like, oh, thanks, man. And that's when I knew, you put it out of... You put it out of your head. You're just going to, I got to go do it now. You know, you talk about it, you tell people about it, you design it, then you go do it, and you're not thinking about it. You're in the zone.
You're never intimidated by
it. I think you're intimidated by the reality of pulling it off, but it's a process. Mm-hmm. You grind the process down. It's that saying, whatever, how do you eat an elephant one bite at a time? It's that type of, you have to have that mentality. That's why I'm saying on San Andreas, I never thought about how am I going to pull these shots off. I was like, I'm going to design the shots I want to see, and I'm hiring really smart people, and they're going to help me figure out how to do it because that's what I want to do. And that was the first time I'd ever done that. So it was a big leap for me where I just literally disengaged from the physical proximities and all the hangups of filmmaking. And it's just this is the story I want to tell. How do I tell it? And get a bunch of people to help.
That's incredible, especially considering your first movie is basically all CG characters. To still have to
Cats and dogs too?
Yeah, right, yeah.
Oh, I mean, it's mostly real animals with...
Well, but with augmentation.
Yeah, with augmentation. Yeah, yeah. The thing that I've heard a lot that I really appreciate is from my casts, where they say, Carla Gugino on San Andreas had said, I've worked with so many filmmakers, really big filmmakers, and they are either really visual and technical or really good with actors. And she said, you're right in the middle. You do both of those things. Mm-hmm. And to me, that was amazing to hear. And then I heard it again from Naomi Harris on Rampage, because, you know, she's a pretty heavy hitting actor. She does her homework. I mean, I was very, on Rampage, the cast is awesome. Jeffrey Dean Morgan. I mean, everybody came super ready to go. And obviously I have a great relationship with Dwayne, and everyone was really dialed in. And I think Dwayne knows, cause I've worked with him a bunch, about how detailed and prepared I am. And I know what I want, and, you know, and I'm also flexible. We work together. I'm there to work with the cast, cause they, you know, when I worked with Michael Caine on Journey 2, he blew me. There were things that I was single word lines or two word lines. And I'd be I thought I pictured it cool, and then he did it, and I was oh my God, this is amazing. You know, literally you're inside, you're giddy. You're turning around, looking at people going, oh my God. When Carla broke down crying because of her daughter in San Andreas, I couldn't look at the monitors because it was, I felt like I was spying on someone having a personal moment. I just had to look away because I was this is wrong. You're not supposed to look at people when they have these moments, you know, I feel this is not okay. But working with people of such a high level of acting and coming from a background where I have no acting experience, I don't know what actors go through, and having worked up to the place where now, having directed Michael Caine and Donald Sutherland and, you know, Jason Momoa and Dwayne and these people, and having them say back to me really positive things about my direction with them, is super rewarding for me because it was the thing I was really most intimidated by when I started. I don't know what other filmmakers go through. So to hear them be like, you know, most filmmakers are either these visual guys who know all the technical stuff or actor people. And for someone to say you do both of those things really well is, it's awesome to hear that, you know?
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, hey guys, we are going to stop our interview with Brad right there. We got so much good stuff that we decided to stretch this out into two episodes. So
you lucky dogs, you.
So we heard a lot about San Andreas. We're going to hear a lot more about Brad's origin story, how he pitches movies, and how he works with Netflix on Frontier. So tune in next time for more of that. And then also please follow us on Twitter. We're at Just Shoot It Pod. And I am at Smitey Pileg.
And I'm at Mr. Matt Enlow. Our music was provided by the Free Music Archive and the artist Jazar.
And our webmaster is Ewan Williams. And this episode was edited by Christopher Robert Gray. Thanks again for tuning in. Catch the next one. Thanks.
Thanks. Bye. Bye.